finally entitled Rilla in Manila or Rumble in the Jungle, but I just couldn't come up with something for Carmel. Thought of Collision on Carmel, but that just didn't sound right. So I decided it wasn't worth thinking about anymore. Showdown on Mount Carmel is a famous story that you probably remember about a contest between Elijah, the prophet of God, and all the prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, to decide once and for all who is the true God. Is it Baal or is it Jehovah? It's a fascinating passage and one that has instruction for us today. As unusual as those circumstances may seem, here thousands of years later, different part of the world. Now we're under the law of Christ, not under the law of Moses, and yet there are certain principles that are revealed in this story which continue to instruct us about spiritual truth. And that's exactly why the Old Testament was recorded, for our instruction, and so we should receive that instruction as best we can. Look at the passage with me tonight. As Brother Norman read a moment ago, Elijah and Ahab meet on the road. And Ahab, this evil king, and make no mistake about it, Ahab was an evil king. His first reaction upon seeing Elijah is, "You're the troublemaker." Elijah, you are the troubler of Israel. And Elijah gives back as good or better when he says, "I have not troubled Israel," verse 18, "but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals." You know, it's an interesting thing that when people do evil, they still try to justify the evil that they do. They still try to rationalize it, excuse it, make it seem like, at least in their own minds, and often they convince many others as well, that what they're doing is perfectly okay and perhaps even preferable. Consequently, those who stand for the right, those who try to uphold truth, they are the ones who are portrayed as being the evildoers, as being the troublemakers. And it will always be so. The reality, the truth was that Israel was suffering, had suffered 3 years of drought, and they had suffered 3 years of drought because of Ahab's obstinance, because of Ahab's disobedience to God. But Ahab didn't see it that way. He insisted that Elijah was the one who was creating the problem. Now, imagine for just a moment the hoops that Ahab had to jump through in his own mind in order to arrive at that conclusion. Elijah was the one who had pronounced the drought because God told him to. And God told him to because Ahab had been worshiping the Baals, and Israel had been worshiping the Baals. And yet, somehow, Ahab blames Elijah for that. But if Elijah was not a true prophet and Jehovah was not a true God, then Elijah could have nothing to do with the rain or the drought. Ahab was the king. Jezebel, his wicked queen, held sway in the court. She got whatever she wanted. The official religion of Israel had more or less become her religion, the worship of Baal, the worship of the Asherah. Elijah could do nothing about that. So how in exactly what way was Elijah the troublemaker? But make no mistake about it, brethren. As even in our own day, our society and our nation suffers because of wickedness. As there is more and more social disorder, family disorder, and all of the evils and all of the consequences that flow from that, from people disobeying the morality of God, the wicked won't acknowledge that they're to blame. They won't. If anything, they'll double down, as the common vernacular is these days. They'll double down on the idea that somehow those of us who are servants of God are to blame, that we're the troublemakers, that we're the ones who are causing problems. It's a perverse and ridiculous argument. It's no more perverse or ridiculous than Ahab saying what he did to Elijah. And so we will be portrayed as being the enemy, even though we all know that if everyone in this nation simply obeyed the will of the Lord, there wouldn't be any societal or family problems. They'd all go away. The drug abuse, the violence, crime, the broken homes, all of the abuse, all of the maliciousness, it'd all go away. We're not to blame. Who's to blame? Those who disobey God. It has always been that way. It's that way today. And so don't let the world portray you as being the troublemaker. See the truth for what it is, and don't be afraid to say it. Verse 19, now then, Elijah says, let's resolve this. You say I'm the troublemaker, I say you're the troublemaker. Let's see if we can't find a solution to this question. Elijah says, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. And we'll settle this. We'll settle it. It's, of course, a fascinating graphic image when you have 950 prophets against one. And it illustrates a point. All you really need is one true prophet. And if you don't have a true prophet, it doesn't matter how many more you have. You can have all the false prophets in the world. Every person in the whole planet could be a false prophet and won't do a lick of good. And that's what we have here in this story. We have 950 to one. And so very often, that's exactly the way it works in the world. That which is popular, that which is seemingly powerful in the way of the world, that which is widely accepted and embraced, that which has official or academic or even governmental authority, is wrong. There's one guy, this one fellow, this one old prophet, he's got the truth. All these other guys are just fake. It doesn't matter if Ahab's the king and Jezebel's the queen. It doesn't matter how many prophets they have on their payroll. They're wrong. And Elijah's going to prove that to them. And God's going to prove that to them, more to the point. Verse 20, so Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And I don't know what Ahab thought was going to happen. I presume that he thought that there would be a discussion or maybe a confrontation. And perhaps Ahab felt comfortable that his 950 prophets and all of his authority was going to put Elijah in his place. But for whatever reason, Ahab bought on to this plan, this scheme, and he said, all right, come on, bring all of you. Come and face Elijah at Mount Carmel. And so they did. Verse 21, Elijah came near to all the people, and he said, how long? How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, and the word translated Lord there, of course, is Jehovah. If Jehovah is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. This is a fascinating statement on the part of Elijah. Elijah says, you people have not really embraced completely and absolutely the worship of Baal. You still, to some degree or in some way, have loyalty to Jehovah God, but not fully, because you have, to a certain degree, embraced the worship of Baal. And so you're trying to do both. You're trying to be loyal to Baal, and you're trying to be loyal to Jehovah. Or you can't make up your mind which is truly God. You need to decide. You need to make up your mind. This needs to stop. It's curious why anybody would do that, but the reality is it's quite common. Being between two opinions is really the easy way out. People avoid making a firm commitment to one view of God, and so they don't really have to strenuously defend that one commitment. They can say, well, I'm not sure, maybe this, maybe that, and I'm being open-minded, and I'm not sure. That makes you sound like you're being fair and honest, open-minded. In reality, all you're doing is being indecisive, non-committal. You vacillate between views because you're not certain. Certainty is a hard thing to have. And if you're not certain, maybe you cover your bases, which is a common way of looking at religion. People think that, well, if I don't truly commit to any one particular view of God, then I can kind of fall back on ignorance, and I can kind of fall back on and say, well, you know, I didn't really know, as if that will be somehow protection in the day of judgment. They give credence to many views, even those that are contradictory. You can't acknowledge God, Jehovah God, as being God, and Baal as being God, because the two are opposing one another. There's no room for Baal in God's world. And if Baal is truly Lord, then Jehovah's not. And so by what rationale, by what logic do you say, well, it could be one or the other, or maybe we'll worship both, which is exactly what the Israelites ended up doing. They practiced syncretism. Syncretism was a common thing in the old world, where people of various pagan religions would just kind of combine and mesh together various beliefs and various gods, and they'd have a pantheon of gods. This is a god, and this other guy's a god, and he's a god, and you got another god, bring him on, we'll embrace all of them. You don't have to decide. You got all our bases covered. If it turns out this guy's really not a god, well, we worship this god, so we're good, right? It doesn't work that way. That is a human rationalization that does not fly with God, and we need to know that. We need to understand that God does not brook, God does not accept competitors in his service. This compromise religion is no compromise at all. Now, you can compromise in matters of judgment. If you're talking about something that's a matter of indifference to God, certainly you can compromise with somebody else. But when it comes to right and wrong, there is no compromise. Somebody says, I want you to jump off a 1,000-foot cliff. And your friend says, don't jump off a cliff at all. Say, well, let's compromise. We'll jump off a 500-foot cliff. And everybody will be happy. Well, that's just stupid. Drinking half the poison is not a compromise. It's death. And failing to be faithful to God, to the one true God, is failure. Absolute and complete. And you need to know that. This is a principle that's taught over and over and over again in the scriptures, that God is a jealous God. You shall have no other gods before me. None. And here's how Elijah puts this. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? And in some period of time of reflection and consideration may be acceptable, but no, you need to make up your mind. You need to decide. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? Another way of translating that, as it is translated in the English Standard Version, is how long will you limp or go limping between two different opinions? You see, when you're trying to walk two paths, or you're trying to wear two different kinds of shoes, or you've got yourself straddled to two different but opposing points of view, you're not going anywhere well. You're limping. It's like straddling a fence. Have you ever tried to straddle a fence? Walk a fence line? It's been a long time since I've done that. If I were to try to do that today, I'd say just go ahead and call the ambulance. There's going to be a need for one. You can't go very far, and certainly not very fast, trying to straddle the fence. You can't. To try to worship Jehovah God and not worship Jehovah God is to do neither one of those things very well. Bible stories are often about having the faith to make the hard choice, and a choice must be made. You can't put the choice off and put the choice off. You can't say, well, maybe this is true, and maybe this is true, and I don't want to ruffle anybody's feathers. And that's the world we live in today. It's all about not offending anybody. But let me tell you something. When you try to live your life by not offending anybody in the area and realm of morality and religion, you offend one person very, very much, and that is God. God's offended. And he's the one entity that you can't afford to offend. The real God will not share our devotion with anything else. That's the point of this story. God's not going to put up with it. So we may live in this multicultural, you know, everybody's right, everybody's wrong, kind of gray society in which you can't say anybody's wrong, and you can't condemn, you can't judge, and how dare you, and brother, we just have to stand up and say, well, I don't buy into that. There is a God. There is a truth. That truth is clear, and that's the truth I embrace, and that's the truth that I'm going to proclaim. If that offends you, then so be it. That's the way it's going to have to be, because the alternative is no alternative. It's not acceptable. It's not going to work. 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 22, then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, here's the choice that you have. I'm the only guy standing on this side. You got 450 guys standing there. This is who you have to choose between. Who are you going to go with? You're going to go with what's popular. You're going to go with the majority. You're going to go with what the government subscribes to and endorses. The official line, is that what you're going to go with? Because you can. On the other side, it's just me. It's only me. So let me propose something to you. He says, bring two bulls. Let those guys, 450 prophets of Baal, let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood. Put no fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire on it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of Jehovah. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. All the people said, that's a good idea. Well, what did they have to lose? Well, they're the spectators, or so they think. For all they care, they're going to see a spectacle. They're just going to be bystanders and watch the show unfold. And maybe something exciting will happen. The truth of the matter is that they should already have made up their mind. This should not have been necessary. You see, God's truth is already clear. And so very often people say, well, I'm waiting for clarity. I'm waiting for a revelation. I'm waiting to learn a little bit more, hear a little bit more. You know, I understand. People, they ought to listen to different points of view. They ought to consider them. They ought to study. But they ought to study. They ought to consider. They ought to decide. But here's the mercy of God. Here's the grace of God. See, God's giving them another chance, a spectacular chance. He's saying to them, this is how much I care about you. Even though I could just judge you, I could just wipe you out, I'm going to show you again. As I've shown you many times before, I'm going to show you again. I'm going to prove to you who is God. Isn't that marvelous that our God does that? Has done that over and over and over again. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Prophets of Baal, they cut up the bull, they put it on the fire, and all morning long, they called, "Oh, Baal, answer us." They shouted. There was no response. No one answered. They danced around the altar that they had made. Don't you know that they were exuberant and excited and forceful, and they had these choreographed dances worked out, and they had all of this elaborate show going on, and it made for a show. All of these appeals and all of these cries meant nothing. Ineffective. Pointless. Vain. There is no Baal. There's no Baal to answer. And all of their traditions and all of their rituals and all of their practices are absolutely 100% meaningless. It's because they're not from God. Purely from the imagination of men. No one to answer, no one to respond. At noon, Elijah mocked them. He watched the show all morning long, and finally he had enough. And he spoke up, and he said, "Cry, cry loud, for he is God." Either he is amusing or he is relieving himself, which is exactly what you think that might be, to ascribe that to Baal, is to insult him, obviously. You know, he's busy, you know, on some personal matters, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. Now, in our culture, in our day and time, this is considered to be offensive and rude and, you know, not politically correct to make fun of somebody else's religion. But let me tell you something. The religions of the world, the religions of paganism, the religions of men, they are ridiculous. They are ridiculous. Make no mistake about that. They are absurd. And whereas it may not be the most effective method in trying to teach somebody to make fun of their religion, I understand that. The truth is, the absolute truth is, that the religions that are not the religion of God, they are absurd. And so, you know, they tried to ignore Elijah, but they got even more dramatic. They cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And I'm sure that made for a show. In most religious rituals of various religions, denominations, and they've got their pageantry, and they've got their show, and they've got their elaborate traditions and rituals, and it does make for quite a show. And some of it's quite loud, and some of it's quite dramatic, and some of it is quite visually and auditorially stimulating. But it is nothing. It means nothing. It may be impressive to men, but not to God. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. There was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. I imagine it got to be kind of embarrassing that nothing was happening. And the more they tried, the more they shouted, the more obvious it was that nothing was going to happen. It doesn't matter how enthusiastic you are. It doesn't matter how zealous you are. It doesn't matter how committed you are, how consciously invested you are. If it's not the truth, it's not the truth. Nothing will come of it. It is pointless. God is not impressed with our zeal when it ignores his will. you to learn that from this story as well as many others in the Bible. Then Elijah said to all the people, "All right, enough of that. You come near me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. He piled wood on the altar and cut the bull into pieces and laid the pieces on the wood. And he said, "Fill four large jars with water and pour the water over the offering and the wood." They dug a trench, a big trench around the offering. And Elijah says, "Bring these big jars of water and you just pour it over everything." And they did. And he says, "Do it again." And they brought more water and they poured it over the wood and the sacrifice and over everything. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they brought more water and they poured it over everything. And then Elijah the prophet came near and he said, "Oh Lord," that's Jehovah. "Jehovah, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and I have done all these things at your word." Now that's effective. When you follow the word of God and you do things the way that the word of God says, that's effective. It has always been effective. It will always be effective. And it doesn't matter how much you do and how much you strive and what energy you invest into your religion, if it's not at the word of God, it is ineffective. It is pointless. But at God's word, because God instructed, because God said, Elijah did these things. And he says, "Now, Lord, you respond because I have done what you said." And he says, "Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Jehovah, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." That's exactly what God's trying to accomplish here. In his mercy and his goodness, he's giving them one more demonstration. "Answer me, Lord, answer me." Elijah doesn't have to rave. He doesn't have to dance about. He doesn't have to cut himself. He simply prays a simple prayer, and he says, "According to your will and your word, O Lord, you act." And he does. And an amazing thing happened. Fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And I just picture this in my head, this tremendous rush of fire, just boom, and it just burns everything up completely. Not just the sacrifice, everything is consumed. Imagine the power of that moment and how bowled over everybody must have been. That's God acting. And when God acts, there's no half measure. And when God says something, it is holy and completely true and effective and eternally effective. That's exactly how effective the sacrifice of Jesus Christ is. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ is like the fire of God, and it will consume and burn up every single sin that you've got. An amazing, beautiful thing. When all the people saw it, they fell face down and said, "Jehovah, he is God. Jehovah, he is God." That's absolutely right. He is God. And it was clear and it was obvious, and there wasn't a person there who didn't know that was true. They should have known that right there. They shouldn't have had to have this demonstration of God's power to know that. They should have done it before. But God in his mercy made it clear to them. And at least they had the honesty. At least they had the bare minimum of common sense to acknowledge what was obvious. That Jehovah is God. It's what we should do. We shouldn't be of half a mind about our faith. We shouldn't be vacillating. We shouldn't be trying to decide, well, what's true and what's not true. God has made it so clear in his word. He has made his presence and his power and his love so obvious. That we, like the Israelites of old, who saw with their own eyes the power of God, should say, "Jehovah is God. Jehovah is God." No question in our mind. That's exactly how convicted that we ought to be. And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape." And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. You don't think that evil will pay? You don't think that people who support and who foster and who back up false religion. You don't think there's a price for that? There absolutely is a price for that. What do you think you're supposed to get out of stories like this in the Old Testament? Now, I know it's true that under the regime of Jesus Christ, we don't inflict capital punishment upon the enemies of Christ. Our battle is a spiritual battle. We convict people through the power of the gospel, and if they choose not to obey it, then God will sort them out later on. It's not for us to decide. And yet, God will decide. God will punish. And he makes it perfectly clear that he will. In the symbolic examples of these Old Testament actions, and in his own words, that the Lord will descend with a shout, and his mighty angels in fire, and will exact vengeance upon those who know not God and who do not obey the gospel. He will. And that vengeance will be more swift and more sure and more fierce than what we... You think that passage troubles you? Should you be troubled by this? That when people don't obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, they're going to answer the Lord for that. That's why we can't vacillate. That's why we can't be unclear and unsure about where we stand. In conclusion, in the service of God, disobedience and indecision are unacceptable. Disobedience is unacceptable. Indecision is unacceptable. Make up your mind. There is truth. It's clear. God will judge us by it. Nothing that you do, your open-mindedness, your vacillation, your trying to straddle the fence, won't change it one bit, one iota. God will judge you by his truth that he has made clear. That is going to happen. If you're on the fence, jump. Jump off it. Get off the fence. There's no safety on the fence. None. That's my lesson tonight. Now, I'm not a prophet, but I believe in the prophets. I can't call down fire out of heaven, but I can call on you to turn your heart back to the Lord. And if you're willing to do that tonight by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ, God has sent his powerful, powerful message and his powerful, powerful son to save you from your sin. Join him. Get on the right side of that. If you need to obey the gospel in baptism, do it tonight as we stand and sing the song of encouragement.